Welcome back to part two of my discussion with Victor Davis Hanson. This is a big topic, crime, of course. I think people, at least in my opinion, underestimate how important the issue of crime is, even in the election of Donald Trump last year. And I see the initiative of the president going in and stopping crime, whether it's in his Washington, D.C., using National Guard or federal law enforcement, or in the ICE, using federal resources to stop crime and clean up cities. And I'm always shocked by the complete opposite impact of what the left keeps saying they want to do for, quote, the poor or minorities, when the minorities and those who live in minority neighborhoods are the people who suffer when crime increases, because crime is more common and violent crime is more common in their neighborhoods. And I just, this whole movement of the left by white, affluent, suburban living liberals to decriminalize crime. And now that there's these minorities in Congress who are now in this elitist world in the Democrat Party, like AOC or Crockett or Ilhan Omar, I wonder, what is the public that naive, that stupid, to fall for this, or am I just getting agitated by watching the news?
Well, I think the public, despite the biased coverage, more or less supports Trump. They surely did in Washington. I don't know in these non-federalized cities, it's going to be more difficult. But the left is not concerned about this, the crime, because for the reasons, one, the people who run the left are either upscale minorities or affluent whites, and their zip code or their security, or they have means of avoiding the consequences of their advocacy, because right, it never boomerangs back. It boomerangs on poor people. And so then they usually say, well, you may be threatened in the ghetto by gangs, but the people who want to stop the crime are racist. They're racist. And that word always resonates, apparently. But the other thing is, they really don't want tough. They don't want tough sentencing, and they don't want hard laws and police forces, because they don't want. They don't believe, first of all, that that's the right thing to do. They want to have alternate sentences. So DeCarlos Brown was a 14-time felon. He should have been in jail for his 14th felony, but Teresa Stokes, who was a DEI-appointed magistrate, a judge in North Carolina, had never passed the bar, never taken the bar. She had no bar degree at all. She may have gone to law school. That's kind of disputed, whether it was a credit or what. But she never passed the bar. She never was asked to take the bar. And she had a vested interest in an alternate treatment program that she was financially benefited. So she sentenced people to that. And so the point is, she doesn't believe that you put a person like that in to protect people. And the left doesn't believe that. And what it does, and they also are very adamant they want to restrict the Second Amendment. So you put it all together and you get the idea they're saying to them, we want a lot of people out there, and we don't really care if they're prone to crime, but we don't want you, the citizen, that don't have the resources that we do to avoid it, private patrols, security, safe neighborhoods. We don't want you to have access to a gun or any way, because we are going to have a monopoly on guns. We're going to have a monopoly on enforcement. And therefore, the crime thing in a certain way is a political weapon. So if you don't support alternative sentencing, more poverty programs, more, you know, counseling, more alternative sentencing, all of that, then you might have to suffer the consequences, and we might not patrol your neighborhood. So the left really likes a complete control of the police and no armed citizens who are vulnerable, and they use that over people. And that's why they're really angry at Trump, because he comes in there and says, you're not protecting poor people or black people, and I'm going to start protecting them. And then they think, well, if he does that, then we have no control over people, because we can decrease or increase the police. We can have certain stop and frisk or no stop and frisk, but we are the ones that adjudicate the level of enforcement and the level of crime. And if you don't like our alternative, because we don't believe that they do, really, the left does not believe in punishment. They really don't, as we define it.
I also believe they don't believe in freedom. I have an interesting anecdote about this police issue that underscores what you just said. I was in Florida last week, and I had the driver of the airport, the car from the airport to my hotel, was a person who lived in Florida for about 30 years, but he came from Cuba. And he was telling me, we got to talking, we had an hour drive, and he was telling me that in Cuba, the first thing that Castro did was he took away people's guns.
Yeah.
Exactly what you're saying. Everything that was done was first initiated by removing individuals who own guns, taking away guns, not just banning guns, but confiscating guns. And he said, this Cuban driver, that there was a very high percentage of individuals who own guns there. And so you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder what people are thinking. Again, this is shocking to me that all these things seem pretty obvious, yet our friends in New York are about to elect a Marxist. A person who says there should be a weak police, that there should be things that are alternatives to enforcing the law. Right out of Marxism, owning the means of production by the state, all kinds of things. And I guarantee you there's going to be very aggressive moves against a gun. Everything they can do, they will try. He, Mamdani, will try to do. And you have to wonder, where is the smart New Yorker, the shrewd New Yorker, the strong New Yorker? The first thing they did was, in my view, they were very weak during the pandemic. I have a lot of friends in New York. If they would have gone to Central Park and sat down and said, you know, we have a million people in Central Park, we're not going to lock down, lock the playgrounds, close the schools. This was insane. But they didn't do that. And now they're electing Mamdani. I don't know what to say about that, except we've seen New York City be a trash heap. And it took Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg to clean up New York. And it became really a great place. And now we're going to see it backslide. What do you think is going on in New York?
Well, first of all, the New York of today is about 1 million plus fewer upper middle class voters who have moved to Tennessee, Florida, the Carolinas in the last 10 years, especially after COVID. So I'd say that just to take 10 people I know that did business in New York, half of them are in Florida now. So that conservative constituency is much, much lower. And then this is not a midterm or a national election, so the vote turnout, it's pathetic if you look at the actual population, not just the register. It's just like 10% of the people voted for him. The other thing is, in this weird type of voting system, if you look at his total, it's about 45% on polls. And then you look at Eric Adams, who just got out, he was about 6 to 8%. And then there's Silva, that's about 13 or 14%. And then there was Cuomo, I think he's about 10 or maybe 15 points, 30. But if you add them all up, the Silva, if he were to get out and Adams were to get out, and Cuomo alone, and they're just one, they're about even, dead even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're splitting anti-Mamdani.
They're splitting vote. The vote out, and the people who are going to vote in this off election, this municipal election with no national election or no statewide to ramp it up, term. It's going to be upscale, white, young professionals who are highly educated. They have prestigious jobs, but they're living in New York and they're making about $100,000 a year. And they look at a $5 million brownstone and the electricity bill, the fuel bill, all of the taxes. And they say, I can't make it.
Yeah, they think they're entitled to living
exactly.
Soho, walking around with their $8 latte,
yes,
but they can't afford the condo that costs $5 million.
No, so they can't.
Getting another job or moving, they think it's somebody else's responsibility to give that to them.
And he's very good on the envy. He says he's going to go after affluent and white neighborhoods. And then these young professionals say, well, those stockbrokers, look at that Porsche they have. Look at that house they have. And look at me. I have a communications degree from Yale, or I have a political science degree from University of Massachusetts or something, and I deserve much better than I'm getting. I'm only an editor at, you know, Alfred Knopf or something. I only make $80,000, and I can't live like I should, what I'm entitled to. And so maybe he's going to spread the wealth around. So that's what his appeal is. And when you don't have a charismatic, I mean, all the candidates were flawed. Eric Adams was a disaster as a mayor. Cuomo, nothing need be said about all of his problems during COVID and the sexual harassment. Curtis Silva's run every time. Good guy, but he never gets more than 8 to 10% of the vote. And so there was no conservative or even regular Democratic alternative. And so
right.
He's going to go in there and maybe it has to get pretty bad. Maybe
right.
He has to do
the
what
pendulum
he says
has to swing so
yes.
bad.
Maybe
until it wakes people up.
I was really amazed, though, when he said he was going to go after affluent, whiter. And then I went, the moment I did that, I did research on ethnic groups by per capita income, you know, and there was about 50 of them in the United States. You know what the number one income group is in America? Indian Americans, Mandami. And it's not even close. Per capita income is like $130,000 a year and per capita, per individual. And not household. And then you go down, I think, so-called white people that don't identify as ethnic like that. They're about 10. You know, there's Japanese American, Chinese American. There's so many groups ahead of just people who identify as white. And yet, if he was going to be honest, and he's a real socialist, he said, I'm going to go into the Indian American communities, the affluent, and tax them higher.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, there's nothing, an honest socialist is an oxymoron. I mean, there's no such thing, in my view, as an honest socialist. It's just very disappointing and sad. Again, I hate to keep saying this, but it's a Gen Z problem. Those are the people who voted in Mamdani in the primary. And those are the people who, if you look at the surveys of employers, two-thirds of employers think that Gen Zs are really, they lack a work ethic, they have a history of the feeling of entitlement, they're not good hires. And so it's not a mode of success. You know, it's a shock to people like you and I, and our generation, I think. And why is it a shock? Because I'm from a family where my, you know, with parents who fought in world wars. I'm from a family of immigrants who came here with literally nothing except a work ethic, nothing. And then we have these people who are, again, walking around in the West Village in New York with their, you know, cortado in their hand, saying, boy, I deserve that $6 million condo that overlooks the Hudson River. It's very sad, but again, the pendulum probably has to swing so far and maybe farther in New York than anywhere to wake people up. We'll see. I want to finish with your ideas on sort of the future. And the first future is the future of the Democrat Party. I mean, the question to me is, yes, the Democrat Party is, I don't think it's just an extreme part of the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party is what it is. It believe your eyes and ears when you see the news. That's what they believe. They believe in the policies they're talking about. So given that that is the Democrat Party, what will happen to the Democrat Party? Will it return to moderation? Will it become an overt socialism party? Will it totally disintegrate or be replaced by a new party?
Well, I don't believe that the hierarchy of the Democratic Party is really ideological, the older guard. Chuck Schumer used to be a friend of Trump. When Clinton was president, he was on the floor giving speeches on closing the borders. There's a good speech by Nancy Pelosi in 96, how wonderful Clinton was because he stopped illegal immigration. Elizabeth Warren wrote a book about how to flip houses and make a quick profit. So they're reacting to what they see as the future of the Democratic Party. They want to ride that wave. And that's a reflection that they believe that we have 55 million people who were not born in the United States. We've never had that many in actual numbers, nor percentage, 16% of the population. 27% of the population of California, of all statuses, green card, citizen, illegal, were not born in the United States. And they believe that when they chastised conservatives and said, oh, you believe that demography is destiny. But they write books called The New Democratic Majority or Demography is Destiny. They call it, when you say it or I say it, they call it the Great Replacement Theory, right wing, you know, paranoia. But they really did believe that they had changed the demography. And to be fair, they did. Under Biden, 10 million people came in illegally. And it was, in their way of thinking, it is moral to break the law, and it is amoral to enforce it like Trump is trying to do. So mm-hmm. What I'm getting at is the Democratic Party, that the people who ran it were paranoid about the young AOCs, the young immigrants, Ilhan Omar, the Jasmine Crocketts, the Squad, all the Black Caucus. They felt that these people were going to be the majority in America, and they were going to open the borders and hasten that. And so
all in order to retain their own power.
Only to retain power, yes. It was all based on basically wealthy white people in the Democratic Party thought our ideas are bankrupt. We're wrong on the green energy. DEI is a disaster. Our foreign policy leads to stuff like Afghanistan pullout. Everything we want, the trans thing is a disaster. So we're going to import people who are going to be dependent on the welfare state, and they'll be Democratic for generations. So that was their strategy. And the problem with it is, number one, it assumes there's always going to be an open border, and people will be able to vote or participate under shadow. I mean, we just found out that under Biden, 4 million people were given Social Security numbers and work permits that were here illegally. And that's just, once you have a work permit and a Social Security number, you can register to vote by mail-in in most states. So my point is, if that changes and the border is secure and we go to legal-only immigration and it's not overturned after Trump leaves, then they don't have a source of new people. So they either have to change the message that most people want, and they won't do that. So they'll start to lose. Or, and this is very interesting, 24% of the Black male vote went to Trump, and the Hispanic male vote was 55%, and the Hispanic vote was 49-48 for Harris. So, or if they think people coming into the country who are not white will not take three or four generations, but are worried about housing and crime and power and gas, they'll lose them. You know, that boutique bi-coastal message doesn't appeal to them. So those are the things that I am confident about, that the Democratic Party will implode and that it's been taken over the cliff by these radicals, and they're not going to get 10 million people under Biden or 2 million people a year to come in and try to find ways to fast track them to voting. And they're going to have a kind of a John Fetterman counter revolution, as they did with Bill Clinton, and they'll
go
back.
So you think that you're saying there will be a rising up of a moderate political leader in the Democrat Party who will eventually be the winning message.
But got to remember, Scott, from 1972 and McGovern to Bill Clinton was 20 years. 20 years. Yeah, it's going to take a long time. And the only...
Is there a room for a third party, really, to become a major thing? Or is that
They never... Third parties serve one purpose. They hurt, they destroy the party they're most aligned with. So,
right. But isn't it true historically in the United States, I'm talking about, 200 years ago, that the Whig Party, that there are total implosions, like you say, of political parties, but they eventually just disintegrate and something else does replace them.
Yes. The MAGA movement itself was created by the Buchanan and then the Perot and then the Tea Party movements, but they were all incorporated in various degrees by Trump, and Trump was the first one to have a leader. They all failed because they didn't have a charismatic leader, mm-hmm. or no leader at all in the case of the Tea Party. But what he did was very brilliant because he didn't run as a third party, and he didn't challenge an incumbent Republican president the way Perot did and the way Buchanan did. He created a third party in the Republican Party in a year that Republicans had no incumbent. That was brilliant. So in 2016, there was not an incumbent that says, it's my birthright to run for re-election, and Trump is going to destroy the Republican brand. He said, it's a free-for-all, and I am the new Republican, and I'm going to get the middle class in. And that was what he did. And the Tea Party, Buchanan, and Perot people joined him. Mm-hmm. So I think the Democratic Party will have to change. Because when you look at these, everybody says 70-30. I'm not sure it's that big, but maybe 60-40 on the issues, on the border, on crime, on fuel and energy, on foreign policy. The current Democratic Party is on the 40% side.
What do you think, last question, about the sort of the vitriol, the hatred, the really severe Trump derangement syndrome type of behavior by the left, by Democrats, by the media? My question is, once Trump is finished, okay, which he's only a couple of years and that goes by very quickly, is that hate against Republicans, is that hate against whoever succeeds him or whoever is the Republican standard bearer, whether or not the Republican wins as president, is that hate there now permanently? Or is this all really personally Trump derangement syndrome? And once he is finally sidelined because of no ability to run again, will it dissipate? What's your sort of thought?
Yeah, I think Trump is a unique person because he's not just a political leader. The reason that you do not see Republicans hitting to the street and demonstrating like you see with the left is they have the rallies. In other words, Donald Trump took popular anger, and Republicans and conservatives are not prone to demonstrate it the way leftists are. But nevertheless, he gave them an outlet. He basically said, come to my rallies and listen to my executive orders, look at my tweets, and you'll see that I'm a street person. And you don't have to go out and protest, because I'll call Nikki Haley a bird brain, or I'll call Ron DeSantis, or I'll call Nancy Pelosi something. But I am a street person. And then second, he told them, in the past, your leaders, Bob Dole, John McCain, Mitt Romney, they were for a particular little political message, privatized Social Security.
Lower
taxes, capital gain. I'm not. I'm a counter-revolutionary. I'm going to look at architecture. I'm going to look at crime in the streets of Portland. I'm going to look at the Smithsonian. I'm going to defund NPR. I'm going to call it the Department of War. Now, it's a total 360 counter-revolution. So basically what he said to the conservative side is, there's no need for you to go out and demonstrate. There's no need for you to do any of that, because I'm the guy, and I am a street fighter. I am a demonstrator. I'm a street guy. I'm a rally guy. I'm a president, and I don't have to follow presidential decorum. So you don't have to worry. Any impulse you have against the left is reified with me. After he goes, and that's what scares the left so much, because he's he is a counter-revolutionary, and he is challenging every single thing they've done for 50 years. I mean, transgendered stuff, DEI indoctrination in the military, the Iran deal, everything was up for grabs. But when he's gone, as much as I like J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, just to take the two obvious choices that might succeed them, I don't see them either with the ambition to do what Trump did or the ability to do with it. You know what I mean? To stage a 24/7 economic, social, cultural, political revolution. So what I think will happen, we'll go back to a more traditional political, this is our political view, this is their political view. But it's kind of like FDR. FDR was kind of like Trump on the opposite side. It wasn't just the New Deal. If you look at Alger, all those people, they were trying to change America. You know, they were trying to socialize America. They were trying to get as close to leftists abroad. And then when he was gone, they got Harry Truman. And he basically said, you know what, I'm going to stick to politics and I'm not going to get into the Roosevelt. We're going to change the nature of man and socialism. And that was pretty much the end of, he institutionalized it, FDR did, but there wasn't another FDR candidate. There was Truman, or there was Adlai Stevenson was nothing, and then you had JFK. But so what I'm getting at is, I think that after Trump stages this counter-revolution, if it's successful, they'll be kind of caretakers, and they will be more political, and that will result in less fury by the left. It's kind of like Reagan and George Bush. As soon as George W. Bush took over, he indirectly criticized Reagan. He said, you know, kinder, gentler nation, thousand points right. of light. And he lost the Reagan revolutionary fervor. And then the left did not hate him like they hated Reagan. They hated Reagan, you know.
Yes.
I remember when they were going to name Reagan Airport, they just went ballistic. So I'm
not
saying it's
Reagan,
good.
Now Reagan's held in a different light because they hate Trump so much.
Yes. They always praise the Republican out of power as preferable and more moderate than the one.
Right.
They love right. George W. Bush now too.
Right.
So, yeah. So I think what I'm trying to say is, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I just don't see any of Trump's successors with that level of energy to keep that counter-revolution ambitious.
Yes, I mean, the one thing is, there's no doubt Donald Trump is an inspirational figure.
Partly because
he was so he was so attacked. Everything about him was attacked. And I think people can identify, Americans seem to identify with somebody who is being attacked by, quote, the system. We talked about the man, you know, the way.
Well, can you think of anybody? I cannot think of anybody else who at one point in 2022-23 was looking at $500 million in fines, another $80 million from E. Jean Carroll. They had the Stormy Dan, every discreet thing about his life was out there. That Steele dossier said he was urinating on prostitutes. They were attacking him. They took his name off the ballot in 25 states. They raided his home. They debanked his wife and son. 93 felony indictments. They had impeached him twice. They tried him as a private citizen. That would have broken any other person. I mean,
no,
if it was 100%. Me, I would have been. No one could go through that. No one could go through that. Said about him. No one. And he was a Nietzschean figure. The more they did it, the stronger he got. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
he said, fight,
absolutely.
Fight, fight. And, you know, that's who he is. There's never going to be anybody like that again.
Not in our lifetimes.
Not in our lifetimes.
I am certain about that.
No,
that
I'm sure about that.
True.
And there's not anybody else who's going to say, I'm going to say whatever I want. And if you don't like it, that's your problem. But I'm going
right.
to try to tell the truth as I see the truth. And if I have to use capital letters, or I have to, you know, tweet a picture of Chris Christie is overweight, I'll do it like a kid. And it's your problem. And that's what gets the left so angry, that he can say anything to anywhere, anytime, to anybody. It's amazing. They all said, well,
it's
we
amazing.
Need more press conferences with Joe Biden. Well, now it's like, they can talk to Trump. They call him up on his cell phone and he talks to them, you know, out of the blue. And
it's sort of we are living in an insane era, but maybe everyone thinks that during the era they live in. But this is unprecedented. There's no doubt about it.
The other thing is, real quickly to finish, you and I know the left really well after being at Stanford. If you dreamed up a candidate that they would hate the most in every dimension of his psyche or physicality, it would be somebody that puts orange makeup on, combs his hair over, has these big long ties, has this weird Queens accent, is really rude and brusque and kind of garish, like Rodney Dangerfield type character. And he pushes every one of the left's buttons. You know, he's not subtle. He's not ambiguous. He's not sophisticated.
And he refuses to back down.
He doesn't change.
And he refuses to be cowed into submission no matter what.
Yes.
And I think this alone is one of the biggest reasons why people, even in the minority communities, but everyone who voted for him, that's very attractive, despite the lack of decorum or whatever else you want to say. That fighter, it really isn't the embodiment of what it means to be
he's
a working
genuine.
Class guy.
He's authentic. Absolutely. Can you imagine him doing what Hillary did by changing her accent? I work so hard. Remember that when she was.
But the beauty is Trump will give it right back to them. Mocking them. And
He came to an ag event and I couldn't go to it in 2000. So I asked a bunch of guys there. I said, so we had the ag event in the Valley. Yeah. And I didn't know much about Trump then. And I said, well, did he come with the caterpillar hat and the jeans as they all do every 4 years? And they said, no.
And I said, now he's wearing a blue suit and a red shirt. Yes.
I said, well, how hot was it? He said, it was 104. And I said, so did he wear the work shirt? No, he had the blue suit and the red tie and the black shoes, and he was sweating like a dog. And I said, well, did he get the Midwestern San Joaquin Valley accent fake? No, he sounded like he was on a Queens taxi driver.
Yeah, perfect.
So he never changes, and that means he's authentic in the eyes of most people.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's why they all had it. Remember the left said that when he was criminalized and he had his photo, you know, the mugshot, that this was going to ruin Trump, and he scowled, and all of a sudden that it went ballistic and viral. That everybody loved his mugshot.
And now he posts it as the official portrait on
the same thing about when they called him garbage. Most people, oh my God, he called us garbage. Then he got in a garbage truck. Or, wow, there's no evidence that Kamala Harris ever worked, as she said, at a McDonald's. Next thing, he's at a McDonald's and smiling.
Right. Doling out the fries.
Yeah. So anyway, we're not going to see anybody like him.
No. All right, anyway. Victor. Well, as always, thank you so much for the time. And, you know, it's always fun talking to you. Thank you.
Take
very
care,
much.
Scott.
All right. See you
Bye.
Soon. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Victor Davis Hanson, check out his website and his terrific podcast, The Victor Davis Hanson Show. Please don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts today, and I'll see you next time.